the beautiful Hélène here, whom it is always delightful to see. When he read that sentence, Pierre felt for the first time that some link which other people recognized had grown up between himself and Hélène, and that thought both alarmed him, as if some obligation were being imposed on him which he could not fulfill, and pleased him, as an entertaining supposition. Anna Pavlovna's at home was like the former one, only the novelty she offered her guests this time was not Mortemart, but a diplomatist fresh from Berlin, with the very latest details of the Emperor Alexander's visit to Potsdam, and of how the two august friends had pledged themselves in an indissoluble alliance to uphold the cause of justice against the enemy of the human race. Anna Pavlovna received Pierre with a shade of melancholy, evidently relating to the young man's recent loss by the death of Count Bezukhov. Everyone constantly considered it a duty to assure Pierre that he was greatly afflicted by the death of the father he had hardly known, and her melancholy was just like the august melancholy she showed at the mention of her most august majesty, the Empress Maria Fyodorovna. Pierre felt flattered by this. Anna Pavlovna arranged the different groups in her drawing-room with her habitual skill. The large group, in which were Prince Vasily and the generals, had the benefit of the diplomat. Another group was at the tea-table. Pierre wished to join the former, but Anna Pavlovna, who was in the excited condition of a commander on a battlefield, to whom thousands of new and brilliant ideas occur, which there is hardly time to put in action, seeing Pierre, touched his sleeve with her finger, saying, "Wait a bit, I have something in view for you this evening." She glanced at Hélène and smiled at her. "My dear Hélène, be charitable to my poor aunt who adores you. Go and keep her company for 10 minutes, and that it will not be too dull, here is the dear Count who will not refuse to accompany you." The beauty went to the aunt, but Anna Pavlovna detained Pierre, looking as if she had to give some final necessary instructions. "Isn't she exquisite?" she said to Pierre, pointing to the stately beauty as she glided away. "And how she carries herself! For so young a girl, such tact, such masterly perfection of manner, it comes from her heart. Happy the man who wins her! With her, the least worldly of men would occupy a most brilliant position in society. Don't you think so? I only wanted to know your opinion." And Anna Pavlovna let Pierre go. Pierre, in reply, sincerely agreed with her as to Hélène's perfection of manner. If he ever thought of Hélène, it was just of her beauty and her remarkable skill in appearing silently dignified in society. The old aunt received the two young people in her corner, but seemed desirous of hiding her adoration for Hélène, and inclining rather to show her fear of Anna Pavlovna. She looked at her niece as if inquiring what she was to do with these people. On leaving them, Anna Pavlovna again touched Pierre's sleeve, saying, "I hope you won't say that it is dull in my house again," and she glanced at Hélène. Hélène smiled, with a look implying that she did not admit the possibility of anyone seeing her without being enchanted. The aunt coughed, swallowed, and said in French that she was very pleased to see Hélène. Then she turned to Pierre with the same words of welcome and the same look. In the middle of a dull and halting conversation, Hélène turned to Pierre with the beautiful bright smile that she gave to everyone. Pierre was so used to that smile, and it had so little meaning for him that he paid no attention to it. The aunt was just speaking of a collection of snuff-boxes that had belonged to Pierre's father, Count Bezukhov, and showed them her own box. Princess Hélène asked to see the portrait of the aunt's husband on the box-lid. "That is probably the work of Vinesse," said Pierre, mentioning a celebrated miniaturist, and he leaned over the table to take the snuff-box while trying to hear what was being said at the other table. He half rose, meaning to go round, but the aunt handed him the snuff-box, passing it across Hélène's back. Hélène stooped forward to make room, and looked round with a smile. She was, as always at evening parties, wearing a dress such as was then fashionable, cut very low at front and back. Her bust, which had always seemed like marble to Pierre, was so close to him that his short-sighted eyes could not but perceive the living charm of her neck and shoulders, so near to his lips that he need only have bent his head a little to have touched them. He was conscious of the warmth of her body, the scent of perfume, and the creaking of her corset as she moved. He did not see her marble beauty forming a complete whole with her dress, but all the charm of her body only covered by her garments. And having once seen this, he could not help being aware of it, just as we cannot renew an illusion we have once seen through. "So, you have never noticed before how beautiful I am," Hélène seemed to say. "You had not noticed that I am a woman." "Yes, I am a woman who may belong to anyone, to you too," said her glance. And at that moment, Pierre felt that Hélène not only could, but must be his wife, and that it could not be otherwise. He knew this at that moment as surely as if he had been standing at the altar with her. How and when this would be, he did not know. He did not even know if it would be a good thing. He even felt, he knew not why, that it would be a bad thing. But he knew it would happen. Pierre dropped his eyes, lifted them again, and wished once more to see her as a distant beauty far removed from him, as he had seen her every day until then. But he could no longer do it. He could not, any more than a man who has been looking at a tuft of steppe-grass through the mist and taking it for a tree, can again take it for a tree after he has recognized it to be a tuft of grass. She was terribly close to him. She already had power over him, and between them there was no longer any barrier, except the barrier of his own will.
"Well, I will leave you in your little corner," came Anna Pavlovna's voice. "I see you are all right there."
And Pierre, anxiously trying to remember whether he had done anything reprehensible, looked round with a blush. It seemed to him that everyone knew what had happened to him, as he knew it himself. A little later, when he went up to the large circle, Anna Pavlovna said to him,
"I hear you are refitting your Petersburg house."
This was true. The architect had told him that it was necessary, and Pierre, without knowing why, was having his enormous Petersburg house done up.
"That's a good thing, but don't move from Prince Vasily's. It is good to have a friend like the prince," she said, smiling at Prince Vasily. "I know something about that, don't I? And you are still so young. You need advice. Don't be angry with me for exercising an old woman's privilege."
She paused, as women always do, expecting something after they have mentioned their age.
"If you marry, it will be a different thing," she continued,
uniting them both in one glance. Pierre did not look at Hélène, nor she at him, but she was just as terribly close to him. He muttered something and coloured. When he got home, he could not sleep for a long time thinking of what had happened. What had happened? Nothing. He had merely understood that the woman he had known as a child, of whom, when her beauty was mentioned, he had said absent-mindedly, "Yes, she's good-looking," he had understood that this woman might belong to him.
"But she's stupid. I have myself said she is stupid," he thought. "There is something nasty, something wrong, in the feeling she excites in me. I have been told that her brother Anatole was in love with her, and she with him, that there was quite a scandal, and that that's why he was sent away. Hippolyte is her brother. Prince Vasily is her father. It's bad," he reflected.
But while he was thinking this, the reflection was still incomplete, he caught himself smiling and was conscious that another line of thought had sprung up, and while thinking of her worthlessness, he was also dreaming of how she would be his wife, how she would love him, become quite different, and how all he had thought and heard of her might be false. And he again saw her not as the daughter of Prince Vasily, but visualized her whole body only veiled by its grey dress.
But no! Why did this thought never occur to me before?
and again he told himself that it was impossible, that there would be something unnatural, and as it seemed to him, dishonourable, in this marriage. He recalled her former words and looks, and the words and looks of those who had seen them together. He recalled Anna Pavlovna's words and looks when she spoke to him about his house, recalled thousands of such hints from Prince Vasily and others, and was seized by terror lest he had already in some way bound himself to do something that was evidently wrong and that he ought not to do. But at the very time he was expressing this conviction to himself, in another part of his mind, her image rose in all its womanly beauty. Chapter 2. Hélène's Name Day. In November 1805, Prince Vasily had to go on a tour of inspection in four different provinces. He had arranged this for himself, so as to visit his neglected estates at the same time, and pick up his son Anatole, where his regiment was stationed, and take him to visit Prince Nikolai Bolkonski, in order to arrange a match for him with the daughter of that rich old man. But before leaving home and undertaking these new affairs, Prince Vasily had to settle matters with Pierre, who, it is true, had latterly spent whole days at home, that is, in Prince Vasily's house where he was staying, and had been absurd, excited, and foolish in Hélène's presence, as a lover should be, but had not yet proposed to her. "This is all very fine, but things must be settled," said Prince Vasily to himself with a sorrowful sigh one morning, feeling that Pierre, who was under such obligations to him, but never mind that, was not behaving very well in this matter. "Youth, frivolity, well, God be with him," thought he, relishing his own goodness of heart, "but it must be brought to a head. The day after tomorrow will be Lelia's name day. I will invite two or three people, and if he does not understand what he ought to do, then it will be my affair. Yes, my affair. I am her father." 6 weeks after Anna Pavlovna's at home, and after the sleepless night when he had decided that to marry Hélène would be a calamity and that he ought to avoid her and go away, Pierre, despite that decision, had not left Prince Vasily's, and felt with terror that in people's eyes he was every day more and more connected with her, that it was impossible for him to return to his former conception of her, that he could not break away from her, and that though it would be a terrible thing, he would have to unite his fate with hers. He might perhaps have been able to free himself, but that Prince Vasily, who had rarely before given receptions, now hardly let a day go by without having an evening party at which Pierre had to be present, unless he wished to spoil the general pleasure and disappoint everyone's expectation. Prince Vasily, in the rare moments when he was at home, would take Pierre's hand in passing and draw it downwards, or absent-mindedly hold out his wrinkled, clean-shaven cheek for Pierre to kiss, and would say, "Till tomorrow," or "Be in to dinner, or I shall not see you," or "I am staying in for your sake," and so on. And though Prince Vasily, when he stayed in, as he said, for Pierre's sake, hardly exchanged a couple of words with him, Pierre felt unable to disappoint him. Every day he said to himself one and the same thing. "It is time I understood her and made up my mind what she really is. Was I mistaken before, or am I mistaken now? No, she is not stupid. She is an excellent girl," he sometimes said to himself. "She never makes a mistake, never says anything stupid. She says little, but what she does say is always clear and simple, so she is not stupid. She never was abashed, and is not abashed now, so she cannot be a bad woman." He had often begun to make reflections or think aloud in her company, and she had always answered him either by a brief but appropriate remark, showing that it did not interest her, or by a silent look and smile, which more palpably than anything else showed Pierre her superiority. She was right in regarding all arguments as nonsense in comparison with that smile. She always addressed him with a radiantly confiding smile meant for him alone, in which there was something more significant than in the general smile that usually brightened her face. Pierre knew that everyone was waiting for him to say a word and cross a certain line, and he knew that sooner or later he would step across it, but an incomprehensible terror seized him at the thought of that dreadful step. 1,000 times during that month and a half, while he felt himself drawn nearer and nearer to that dreadful abyss, Pierre said to himself, "What am I doing? I need resolution. Can it be that I have none?" He wished to take a decision, but felt with dismay that in this matter he lacked that strength of will which he had known in himself and really possessed. Pierre was one of those who are only strong when they feel themselves quite innocent, and since that day when he was overpowered by a feeling of desire while stooping over the snuff-box at Anna Pavlovna's, an unacknowledged sense of the guilt of that desire paralyzed his will. On Hélène's name day, a small party of just their own people, as his wife said, met for supper at Prince Vasily's. All these friends and relations had been given to understand that the fate of the young girl would be decided that evening. The visitors were seated at supper. Princess Kuragina, a portly, imposing woman who had once been handsome, was sitting at the head of the table. On either side of her sat the more important guests, an old general and his wife, and Anna Pavlovna Scherer. At the other end sat the younger and less important guests, and there, too, sat the members of the family, and Pierre and Hélène, side by side. Prince Vasily was not having any supper. He went round the table in a merry mood, sitting down now by one, now by another of the guests. To each of them he made some careless and agreeable remark, except to Pierre and Hélène, whose presence he seemed not to notice. He enlivened the whole party. The wax candles burned brightly, the silver and crystal gleamed, so did the ladies' toilettes and the gold and silver of the men's epaulettes. Servants in scarlet liveries moved round the table. The clatter of plates, knives and glasses mingled with the animated hum of several conversations. At one end of the table, the old chamberlain was heard assuring an old baroness that he loved her passionately, at which she laughed. At the other could be heard the story of the misfortunes of some Maria Viktorovna or other. At the centre of the table, Prince Vasily attracted everybody's attention. With a facetious smile on his face, he was telling the ladies about last Wednesday's meeting of the Imperial Council, at which Sergei Kuzmich Vyazmitinov, the new military governor-general of Petersburg, had received and read the then-famous rescript of the Emperor Alexander from the army to Sergei Kuzmich, in which the emperor said that he was receiving from all sides declarations of the people's loyalty, that the declaration from Petersburg gave him particular pleasure, and that he was proud to be at the head of such a nation and would endeavour to be worthy of it. This rescript began with the words, "Sergei Kuzmich, from all sides reports reach me." "Well, and so he never got farther than Sergei Kuzmich?" asked one of the ladies. "Exactly. Not a hair's breadth, father," answered Prince Vasily, laughing. "Sergei Kuzmich, from all sides, Sergei Kuzmich." "Poor Vyazmitinov could not get any farther. He began the rescript again and again, but as soon as he uttered Sergei, he sobbed Kuzmich in tears, and from all sides was smothered in sobs, and he could get no farther. And again his handkerchief, and again Sergei Kuzmich from all sides, and tears, till at last somebody else was asked to read it. Kuzmich from all sides, and then tears," someone repeated, laughing. "Don't be unkind," cried Anna Pavlovna from her end of the table, holding up a threatening finger. "He is such a worthy and excellent man, our dear Vyazmitinov." Everybody laughed a great deal. At the head of the table, where the honoured guests sat, everyone seemed to be in high spirits and under the influence of a variety of exciting sensations. Only Pierre and Hélène sat silently side by side, almost at the bottom of the table, a suppressed smile brightening both their faces, a smile that had nothing to do with Sergei Kuzmich, a smile of bashfulness at their own feelings. But much as all the rest laughed, talked, and joked, much as they enjoyed their Rhine wine, sauté, and ices, and however they avoided looking at the young couple, and heedless and unobservant as they seemed of them, one could feel by the occasional glances they gave that the story about Sergei Kuzmich, the laughter and the food, were all a pretense, and that the whole attention of that company was directed to Pierre and Hélène. Prince Vasily mimicked the sobbing of Sergei Kuzmich, and at the same time his eyes glanced toward his daughter, and while he laughed, the expression on his face clearly said, "Yes, it's getting on. It will all be settled today." Anna Pavlovna threatened him on behalf of our dear Vyazmitinov, and in her eyes, which for an instant glanced at Pierre, Prince Vasily read a congratulation on his future son-in-law and on his daughter's happiness. The old princess sighed sadly as she offered some wine to an old lady next to her, and glanced angrily at her daughter, and her sigh seemed to say, "Yes, there's nothing left for you and me but to sip sweet wine, my dear, now that the time has come for these young ones to be thus boldly, provocatively happy." "And what nonsense all this is that I am saying," thought a diplomatist, glancing at the happy faces of the lovers. "That's happiness." Into the insignificant, trifling, and artificial interests uniting that society had entered the simple feeling of the attraction of a healthy and handsome young man and woman for one another. And this human feeling dominated everything else and soared above all their affected chatter. Jests fell flat, news was not interesting, and the animation was evidently forced. Not only the guests, but even the footmen waiting at table seemed to feel this, and they forgot their duties as they looked at the beautiful Hélène with her radiant face and at the red, broad and happy, though uneasy, face of Pierre. It seemed as if the very light of the candles was focused on those two happy faces alone. Pierre felt that he was at the centre of it all, and this both pleased and embarrassed him. He was like a man entirely absorbed in some occupation. He did not see, hear, or understand anything clearly. Only now and then detached ideas and impressions from the world of reality shot unexpectedly through his mind. "So, it is all finished," he thought. "And how has it all happened? How quickly? Now I know that not because of her alone, nor of myself alone, but because of everyone, it must inevitably come about. They are all expecting it. They are so sure that it will happen that I cannot disappoint them. But how will it be? I do not know. But it will certainly happen," thought Pierre, glancing at those dazzling shoulders close to his eyes. Or he would suddenly feel ashamed of he knew not what. He felt it awkward to attract everyone's attention and to be considered a lucky man, and with his plain face to be looked on as a sort of Paris possessed of a Helen. "No doubt it always is, and must be so," he consoled himself. "And besides, what have I done to bring it about? How did it begin? I travelled from Moscow with Prince Vasily. Then there was nothing. So why should I not stay at his house? Then I played cards with her, and picked up her reticule and drove out with her. How did it begin? When did it all come about?" And here he was, sitting by her side as her betrothed, seeing, hearing, feeling her nearness, her breathing, her movements, her beauty. Then it would suddenly seem to him that it was not she, but he was so unusually beautiful, and that that was why they all looked so at him. And flattered by this general admiration, he would expand his chest, raise his head, and rejoice at his good fortune. Suddenly he heard a familiar voice repeating something to him a second time, but Pierre was so absorbed that he did not understand what was said. "I am asking you when you last heard from Bolkonski," repeated Prince Vasily a third time. "How absent-minded you are, my dear fellow." Prince Vasily smiled, and Pierre noticed that everyone was smiling at him and Hélène. "Well, what of it, if you all know it?" thought Pierre. "What of it? It's the truth." And he himself smiled his gentle childlike smile, and Hélène smiled too. "When did you get the letter? Was it from old Mutz?" repeated Prince Vasily, who pretended to want to know this in order to settle a dispute.
"How can one talk or think of such trifles?" thought Pierre.
"Yes, from Olmütz," he answered with a sigh. After supper, Pierre with his partner followed the others into the drawing-room. The guests began to disperse, some without taking leave of Hélène. Some, as if unwilling to distract her from an important occupation, came up to her for a moment and made haste to go away, refusing to let her see them off. The diplomatist preserved a mournful silence as he left the drawing-room. He pictured the vanity of his diplomatic career in comparison with Pierre's happiness. The old general grumbled at his wife when she asked how his leg was. "Oh, the old fool," he thought. "That Princess Hélène will be beautiful still when she's 50.
"I think I may congratulate you," whispered Anna Pavlovna to the old princess, kissing her soundly. "If I hadn't this headache, I'd have stayed longer."
The old princess did not reply. She was tormented by jealousy of her daughter's happiness. While the guests were taking their leave, Pierre remained for a long time alone with Hélène in the little drawing-room where they were sitting. He had often before, during the last 6 weeks, remained alone with her, but had never spoken to her of love. Now he felt that it was inevitable, but he could not make up his mind to take the final step. He felt ashamed. He felt that he was occupying someone else's place here beside Hélène. "This happiness is not for you," some inner voice whispered to him. "This happiness is for those who have not in them what there is in you." But as he had to say something, he began by asking her whether she was satisfied with the party. She replied in her usual simple manner that this name day of hers had been one of the pleasantest she had ever had. Some of the nearest relatives had not yet left. They were sitting in the large drawing-room. Prince Vasily came up to Pierre with languid footsteps. Pierre rose and said it was getting late. Prince Vasily gave him a look of stern inquiry, as though what Pierre had just said was so strange that one could not take it in. But then the expression of severity changed, and he drew Pierre's hand downwards, made him sit down, and smiled affectionately. "Well, Lelia," he asked, turning instantly to his daughter and addressing her with the careless tone of habitual tenderness natural to parents who have petted their children from babyhood, but which Prince Vasily had only acquired by imitating other parents. And again he turned to Pierre.
"Sergei Kuzmich, from all sides," he said, unbuttoning the top button of his waistcoat.
Pierre smiled, but his smile showed that he knew it was not the story about Sergei Kuzmich that interested Prince Vasily just then. And Prince Vasily saw that Pierre knew this. He suddenly muttered something and went away. It seemed to Pierre that even the prince was disconcerted. The sight of the discomposure of that old man of the world touched Pierre. He looked at Hélène, and she too seemed disconcerted, and her look seemed to say, "Well, it's all your own fault."
"The step must be taken, but I cannot, thought Pierre, and again began speaking about indifferent matters, about Sergei Kuzmich, asking what the point of the story was, as he had not heard it properly. Hélène answered with a smile that she, too, had missed it.
When Prince Vasily returned to the drawing-room, the princess, his wife, was talking in low tones to the elderly lady about Pierre.
"Of course, it is a very brilliant match, but happiness, my dear."
"Marriages are made in heaven," replied the elderly lady.
Prince Vasily passed by, seeming not to hear the ladies, and sat down on a sofa in a far corner of the room. He closed his eyes and seemed to be dozing. His head sank forward, and then he roused himself.
"Aline,"
he said to his wife,
"go and see what they are about."
The princess went up to the door, passed by it with a dignified and indifferent air, and glanced into the little drawing-room. Pierre and Hélène still sat talking just as before.
"Still the same," she said to her husband.
Prince Vasily frowned, twisting his mouth. His cheeks quivered and his face assumed the coarse, unpleasant expression peculiar to him. Shaking himself, he rose, threw back his head, and with resolute steps went past the ladies into the little drawing-room. With quick steps he went joyfully up to Pierre. His face was so unusually triumphant that Pierre rose in alarm on seeing it.
"Thank God," said Prince Vasily. "My wife has told me everything."
He put one arm around Pierre and the other around his daughter.
"My dear boy, Lelia, I am very pleased." His voice trembled. "I loved your father, and she will make you a good wife. God bless you."
He embraced his daughter, and then again Pierre, and kissed him with his malodorous mouth. Tears actually moistened his cheeks.
"Princess, come here," he shouted.
The old princess came in and also wept. The elderly lady was using her handkerchief, too. Pierre was kissed, and he kissed the beautiful Hélène's hand several times. After a while, they were left alone again. "All this had to be, and could not be otherwise," thought Pierre, "so it is useless to ask whether it is good or bad. It is good, because it's definite and one is rid of the old tormenting doubt." Pierre held the hand of his betrothed in silence, looking at her beautiful bosom as it rose and fell. "Hélène," he said aloud, and paused. "Something special is always said in such cases," he thought, but could not remember what it was that people say. He looked at her face. She drew nearer to him, her face flushed.
"Oh, take those off, those," she said, pointing to his spectacles.
Pierre took them off, and his eyes, besides the strange look eyes have from which spectacles have just been removed, had also a frightened and inquiring look. He was about to stoop over her hand and kiss it, but with a rapid, almost brutal movement of her head, she intercepted his lips and met them with her own. Her face struck Pierre by its altered, unpleasantly excited expression. "It is too late now. It's done. Besides, I love her," thought Pierre. "Je vous aime," he said, remembering what has to be said at such moments, but his words sounded so weak that he felt ashamed of himself. 6 weeks later, he was married and settled in Count Bezukhov's large, newly furnished Petersburg house, the happy possessor, as people said, of a wife who was a celebrated beauty and of millions of money. Chapter 3. Prince Vasily and Anatole visit Prince Nikolai. Old Prince Nikolai Bolkonski received a letter from Prince Vasily in November 1805, announcing that he and his son would be paying him a visit.
"I am starting on a journey of inspection, and of course I shall think nothing of an extra 70 miles to come and see you at the same time, my honoured benefactor," wrote Prince Vasily. "My son Anatole is accompanying me on his way to the army, so I hope you will allow him personally to express the deep respect that, emulating his father, he feels for you."
"It seems that there will be no need to bring Maria out. Suitors are coming to us of their own accord," incautiously remarked the little princess on hearing the news. Prince Nikolai frowned, but said nothing.
A fortnight after the letter, Prince Vasily's servants came one evening in advance of him, and he and his son arrived next day. Old Bolkonski had always had a poor opinion of Prince Vasily's character, but more so recently, since in the new reigns of Paul and Alexander, Prince Vasily had risen to high position and honours. And now, from the hints contained in his letter and given by the little princess, he saw which way the wind was blowing, and his low opinion changed into a feeling of contemptuous ill-will. He snorted whenever he mentioned him. On the day of Prince Vasily's arrival, Prince Bolkonski was particularly discontented and out of temper. Whether he was in a bad temper because Prince Vasily was coming, or whether his being in a bad temper made him specially annoyed at Prince Vasily's visit, he was in a bad temper, and in the morning Tichon had already advised the architect not to go to the prince with his report.
"Do you hear how he's walking?" said Tichon, drawing the architect's attention to the sound of the prince's footsteps. "Stepping flat on his heels. We know what that means."
However, at 9 o'clock, the prince, in his velvet coat with a sable collar and cap, went out for his usual walk. It had snowed the day before, and the path to the hothouse, along which the prince was in the habit of walking, had been swept. The marks of the broom were still visible in the snow, and a shovel had been left sticking in one of the soft snowbanks that bordered both sides of the path. The prince went through the conservatories, the serfs' quarters, and the outbuildings, frowning and silent.
"Can a sleigh pass?"
he asked his overseer, a venerable man resembling his master in manners and looks, who was accompanying him back to the house.
"The snow is deep. I'm having the avenue swept, Your Honour."
The prince bowed his head and went up to the porch.
"God be thanked," thought the overseer. "The storm has blown over."
"It would have been hard to drive up, Your Honour," he added. "I urge, Your Honour, that a minister is coming to visit, Your Honour."
The prince turned round to the overseer and fixed his eyes on him, frowning.
"What? A minister? What minister? Who gave orders?"
he said in his shrill, harsh voice.
"The road is not swept for the princess, my daughter, but for a minister. For me there are no ministers."
"Your Honour, I thought..."
"You thought..."
shouted the prince, his words coming more and more rapidly and indistinctly.
"You thought? Rascals, blackguards, I'll teach you to think!"
And lifting his stick, he swung it and would have hit Alpátych, the overseer, had not the latter instinctively avoided the blow.
"Thought? Blackguards!"
shouted the prince rapidly. But although Alpátych, frightened at his own temerity in avoiding the stroke, came up to the prince, bowing his bald head resignedly before him, or perhaps for that very reason, the prince, though he continued to shout, "Blackguards, throw the snow back on the road," did not lift his stick again, but hurried into the house. Before dinner, Princess Maria and Mademoiselle Bourienne, who knew that the prince was in a bad humour, stood awaiting him. Mademoiselle Bourienne, with a radiant face that said, "I know nothing, I am the same as usual," and Princess Maria, pale, frightened, and with downcast eyes. What she found hardest to bear was to know that on such occasions she ought to behave like Mademoiselle Bourienne, but could not. She thought, "If I seem not to notice, he will think that I do not sympathise with him. If I seem sad and out of spirits myself, he will say, as he has done before, that I'm in the dumps." The prince looked at his daughter's frightened face and snorted.
"Fool, or dummy," he muttered. "And the other one is not here. They've been telling tales," he thought, referring to the little princess who was not in the dining room. "Where is the princess?" he asked. "Hiding?"
"She is not very well," answered Mademoiselle Bourienne with a bright smile. "So she won't come down. It is natural in her state."
Muttered the prince, sitting down. His plate seemed to him not quite clean, and pointing to a spot he flung it away. Tichon caught it and handed it to a footman. The little princess was not unwell, but had such an overpowering fear of the prince that, hearing he was in a bad humour, she had decided not to appear.
"I am afraid for the baby," she said to Mademoiselle Bourienne. "Heaven knows what a fright might do."
In general, at Bald Hills, the little princess lived in constant fear, and with a sense of antipathy to the old prince which she did not realise, because the fear was so much the stronger feeling. The prince reciprocated this antipathy, but it was overpowered by his contempt for her. When the little princess had grown accustomed to life at Bald Hills, she took a special fancy to Mademoiselle Bourienne, spent whole days with her, asked her to sleep in her room, and often talked with her about the old prince and criticised him.
"So we are to have visitors, mon prince," remarked Mademoiselle Bourienne, unfolding her white napkin with her rosy fingers. "His Excellency Prince Vasily Kuragin and his son, I understand," she said inquiringly.
"His Excellency is a puppy, I got him his appointment in the service, said the prince disdainfully. Why his son is coming, I don't understand. Perhaps Princess Elisaveta and Princess Maria know. I don't want him.
He looked at his blushing daughter.
Are you unwell today, eh? Afraid of the minister, as that idiot Alpátych called him this morning?
No, mon père.
Though Mademoiselle Bourienne had been so unsuccessful in her choice of a subject, she did not stop talking, but chattered about the conservatories and the beauty of a flower that had just opened, and after the soup the prince became more genial. After dinner he went to see his daughter-in-law. The little princess was sitting at a small table, chattering with Masha, her maid. She grew pale on seeing her father-in-law. She was much altered. She was now plain rather than pretty. Her cheeks had sunk, her lip was drawn up, and her eyes drawn down.
"Yes, I feel a kind of oppression," she said in reply to the prince's question as to how she felt.
"Do you want anything?"
"No, merci, mon père."
"Well, all right, all right."
He left the room and went into the waiting room, where Alpátych stood with bowed head.
"Has the snow been shovelled back?"
"Yes, Your Excellency. Forgive me, for heaven's sake. It was only my stupidity."
"All right, all right,"
interrupted the prince, and laughing his unnatural way, he stretched out his hand for Alpátych to kiss, and then proceeded to his study. Prince Vasily arrived that evening. He was met in the avenue by coachmen and footmen, who, with loud shouts, dragged his sleighs up to one of the lodges over the road purposely laden with snow. Prince Vasily and Anatole had separate rooms assigned to them. Anatole, having taken off his overcoat, sat with arms akimbo before a table, on a corner of which he smilingly and absent-mindedly fixed his large and handsome eyes. He regarded his whole life as a continual round of amusement which someone, for some reason, had to provide for him, and he looked on this visit to a churlish old man and a rich and ugly heiress in the same way. All this might, he thought, turn out very well and amusingly. "And why not marry her if she really has so much money? That never does any harm," thought Anatole. He shaved and scented himself with the care and elegance which had become habitual to him, and, his handsome head held high, entered his father's room with a good-humoured and victorious air natural to him. Prince Vasily's two valets were busy dressing him, and he looked round with much animation and cheerfully nodded to his son as the latter entered, as if to say, "Yes, that's how I want you to look." "I say, father, joking apart, is she very hideous?" Anatole asked, as if continuing a conversation the subject of which had often been mentioned during the journey.
"Enough! What nonsense! Above all, try to be respectful and cautious with the old prince."
"If he starts a row, I'll go away," said Prince Anatole. "I can't bear those old men, eh?"
"Remember, for you, everything depends on this."
In the meantime, not only was it known in the maidservants' rooms that the minister and his son had arrived, but the appearance of both had been minutely described. Princess Maria was sitting alone in her room, vainly trying to master her agitation.
"Why did they write? Why did Lisa tell me about it? It can never happen," she said, looking at herself in the glass. "How shall I enter the drawing-room? Even if I like him, I can't now be myself with him."
The mere thought of her father's look filled her with terror. The little princess and Mademoiselle Bourienne had already received from Masha, the lady's maid, the necessary report of how handsome the minister's son was, with his rosy cheeks and dark eyebrows, and with what difficulty the father had dragged his legs upstairs, while the son had followed him like an eagle, three steps at a time. Having received this information, the little princess and Mademoiselle Bourienne, whose chattering voices had reached her from the corridor, went into Princess Maria's room.
"You know they've come, Marie," said the little princess, waddling in and sinking heavily into an armchair.
She was no longer in the loose gown she generally wore in the morning, but had on one of her best dresses. Her hair was carefully done, and her face was animated, which, however, did not conceal its sunken and faded outlines. Dressed as she used to be in Petersburg society, it was still more noticeable how much plainer she had become. Some unobtrusive touch had been added to Mademoiselle Bourienne's toilette, which rendered her fresh and pretty face yet more attractive.
"What? Are you going to remain as you are, dear princess?" she began. "They'll be announcing that the gentlemen are in the drawing-room, and we shall have to go down, and you have not smartened yourself up at all."
The little princess got up, rang for the maid, and hurriedly and merrily began to devise and carry out a plan of how Princess Maria should be dressed. Princess Maria's self-esteem was wounded by the fact that the arrival of a suitor agitated her, and still more so by both her companions not having the least conception that it could be otherwise. To tell them that she felt ashamed for herself and for them would be to betray her agitation, while to decline their offers to dress her would prolong their banter and insistence. She flushed. Her beautiful eyes grew dim. Red blotches came on her face, and it took on the unattractive, martyr-like expression it so often wore as she submitted herself to Mademoiselle Bourienne and Lisa. Both these women quite sincerely tried to make her look pretty. She was so plain that neither of them could think of her as a rival, so they began dressing her with perfect sincerity and with the naive and firm conviction women have that dress can make a face pretty.
"No, really, my dear, this dress is not pretty," said Lisa, looking sideways at Princess Maria from a little distance. "You have a maroon dress. Have it fetched, really. You know the fate of your whole life may be at stake, but this one is too light. It's not becoming."
It was not the dress, but the face and whole figure of Princess Maria that was not pretty. But neither Mademoiselle Bourienne nor the little princess felt this. They still thought that if a blue ribbon were placed in the hair combed up and the blue scarf arranged lower on the best maroon dress and so on, all would be well. They forgot that the frightened face and the figure could not be altered, and that however they might change the setting and adornment of that face, it would still remain piteous and plain. After two or three changes to which Princess Maria meekly submitted, just as her hair had been arranged on the top of her head, a style that quite altered and spoiled her looks, and she had put on a maroon dress with a pale blue scarf, the little princess walked twice round her, now adjusting a fold of the dress with her little hand, now arranging the scarf and looking at her with her head bent first on one side and then on the other.
"No, it will not do," she said decidedly, clasping her hands. "No, Maria, really, this dress does not suit you. I prefer you in your little grey everyday dress. Now, please, do it for my sake. Katie," she said to the maid, "bring the princess her grey dress. And you'll see, Mademoiselle Bourienne, how I shall arrange it," she added, smiling with a foretaste of artistic pleasure.
But when Katie brought the required dress, Princess Maria remained sitting motionless before the glass, looking at her face, and saw in the mirror her eyes full of tears and her mouth quivering, ready to burst into sobs.
"Come, dear princess," said Mademoiselle Bourienne, "just one more little effort."
The little princess, taking the dress from the maid, came up to Princess Maria.
"Well, now we'll arrange something quite simple and becoming," she said.
The three voices, hers, Mademoiselle Bourienne's, and Katie's, who was laughing at something, mingled in a merry sound like the chirping of birds.
"No, leave me alone," said Princess Maria.
Her voice sounded so serious and so sad that the chirping of the birds was silenced at once. They looked at the beautiful, large, thoughtful eyes, full of tears and of thoughts, gazing shiningly and imploringly at them, and understood that it was useless and even cruel to insist.
"At least change your coiffure," said the little princess. "Didn't I tell you," she went on, turning reproachfully to Mademoiselle Bourienne, "Maria's is a face which such a coiffure does not suit in the least, not in the least. Please change it." "Leave me alone. Please leave me alone. It is all quite the same to me," answered a voice struggling with tears.
Mademoiselle Bourienne and the little princess had to own to themselves that Princess Maria in this guise looked very plain, worse than usual, but it was too late. She was looking at them with an expression they both knew, an expression thoughtful and sad. This expression in Princess Maria did not frighten them, she never inspired fear in anyone, but they knew that when it appeared on her face, she became mute and was not to be shaken in her determination.
"You will change it, won't you?" said Lisa.
And as Princess Maria gave no answer, she left the room. Princess Maria was left alone. She did not comply with Lisa's request. She not only left her hair as it was, but did not even look in her glass. Letting her arms fall helplessly, she sat with downcast eyes and pondered. A husband, a man, a strong, dominant, and strangely attractive being, rose in her imagination and carried her into a totally different, happy world of his own. She fancied a child, her own, such as she had seen the day before in the arms of her nurse's daughter, at her own breast, the husband standing by and gazing tenderly at her and the child. "But no, it is impossible. I am too ugly," she thought.
"Please come to tea. The prince will be out in a moment," came the maid's voice at the door.
She roused herself and felt appalled at what she had been thinking, and before going down she went into the room where the icons hung, and her eyes fixed on the dark face of a large icon of the Saviour lit by a lamp, she stood before it with folded hands for a few moments. A painful doubt filled her soul. Could the joy of love, of earthly love for a man, be for her? In her thoughts of marriage, Princess Maria dreamed of happiness and of children, but her strongest, most deeply hidden longing was for earthly love. The more she tried to hide this feeling from others and even from herself, the stronger it grew.
"Oh God," she said, "how am I to stifle in my heart these temptations of the devil? How am I to renounce forever these vile fancies, so as peacefully to fulfil thy will?"
And scarcely had she put that question than God gave her the answer in her own heart. "Desire nothing for thyself, seek nothing, be not anxious or envious. Man's future and thy own fate must remain hidden from thee, but live so that thou mayest be ready for anything. If it be God's will to prove thee in the duties of marriage, be ready to fulfil his will." With this consoling thought, but yet with a hope for the fulfilment of her forbidden earthly longing, Princess Maria sighed, and having crossed herself, went down, thinking neither of her gown and coiffure, nor of how she would go in, nor of what she would say. What could all that matter in comparison with the will of God, without whose care not a hair of man's head can fall? Chapter 4. When Princess Maria came down, Prince Vasily and his son were already in the drawing-room, talking to the little princess and Mademoiselle Bourienne. When she entered with her heavy step, treading on her heels, the gentleman and Mademoiselle Bourienne rose, and the little princess, indicating her to the gentleman, said, "Voilà, Marie!" Princess Maria saw them all, and saw them in detail. She saw Prince Vasily's face, serious for an instant at the sight of her, but immediately smiling again, and the little princess curiously noting the impression Marie produced on the visitors. And she saw Mademoiselle Bourienne, with her ribbon and pretty face, and her unusually animated look which was fixed on him, but him she could not see. She only saw something large, brilliant, and handsome moving towards her as she entered the room. Prince Vasily approached first, and she kissed the bald forehead that bent over her hand, and answered his question by saying that, on the contrary, she remembered him quite well. Then Anatole came up to her. She still could not see him. She only felt a soft hand taking hers firmly, and she touched with her lips a white forehead, over which was beautiful light brown hair smelling of pomade. When she looked up at him, she was struck by his beauty. Anatole stood with his right thumb under a button of his uniform, his chest expanded and his back drawn in, slightly swinging one foot, and with his head a little bent, looked with beaming face at the princess without speaking, and evidently not thinking about her at all. Anatole was not quick-witted, nor ready or eloquent in conversation, but he had the faculty so invaluable in society of composure and imperturbable self-possession. If a man lacking in self-confidence remains dumb on a first introduction and betrays a consciousness of the impropriety of such silence and an anxiety to find something to say, the effect is bad. But Anatole was dumb, swung his foot and smilingly examined the princess's hair. It was evident that he could be silent in this way for a very long time. "If anyone finds this silence inconvenient, let him talk, but I don't want to," he seemed to say. Besides this, in his behaviour to women, Anatole had a manner which particularly inspires in them curiosity, awe, and even love, a supercilious consciousness of his own superiority. It was as if he said to them, "I know you. I know you, but why should I bother about you? You'd be only too glad, of course." Perhaps he did not really think this when he met women. Even probably he did not, for in general he thought very little. But his looks and manner gave that impression. The princess felt this, and as if wishing to show him that she did not even dare expect to interest him, she turned to his father. The conversation was general and animated, thanks to Princess Lisa's voice and little downy lip that lifted over her white teeth. She met Prince Vasily with that playful manner often employed by lively, chatty people, and consisting in the assumption that between the person they so address and themselves there are some semi-private, long-established jokes and amusing reminiscences, though no such reminiscences really exist, just as none existed in this case. Prince Vasily readily adopted her tone, and the little princess also drew Anatole, whom she hardly knew, into these amusing recollections of things that had never occurred. Mademoiselle Bourienne also shared them, and even Princess Maria felt herself pleasantly made to share in these merry reminiscences.
"Here, at least, we shall have the benefit of your company all to ourselves, dear prince," said the little princess, of course in French, to Prince Vasily. "It is not as at Annette's receptions, where you always ran away. You remember cette chère Annette?"
"Ah, but you won't talk politics to me like Annette."
"And our little tea table?"
"Oh, yes."
"Why is it you are never at Annette's?" the little princess asked Anatole. "Ah, I know, I know," she said with a sly glance. "Your brother Hippolyte told me about your goings-on." "Oh," and she shook her finger at him. "I have even heard of your doings in Paris."
"And didn't Hippolyte tell you," asked Prince Vasily, turning to his son and seizing the little princess's arm as if she would have run away and he had just managed to catch her, "didn't he tell you how he himself was pining for the dear princess and how she showed him the door? Oh, she is a pearl among women, princess," he added, turning to Princess Maria.
When Paris was mentioned, Mademoiselle Bourienne, for her part, seized the opportunity of joining in the general current of recollections. She took the liberty of inquiring whether it was long since Anatole had left Paris and how he had liked that city. Anatole answered the Frenchwoman very readily, and looking at her with a smile, talked to her about her native land. When he saw the pretty little Bourienne, Anatole came to the conclusion that he would not find Bald Hills dull either.
"Not at all bad," he thought, examining her. "Not at all bad, that little companion. I hope she will bring her along with her when we're married. La petite est gentille."
The old prince dressed leisurely in his study, frowning and considering what he was to do. The coming of these visitors annoyed him.
"What are Prince Vasily and that son of his to me? Prince Vasily is a shallow braggart, and his son, no doubt, is a fine specimen," he grumbled to himself.
What angered him was that the coming of these visitors revived in his mind an unsettled question he always tried to stifle, one about which he always deceived himself. The question was whether he could ever bring himself to part from his daughter and give her to a husband. The prince never directly asked himself that question, knowing beforehand that he would have to answer it justly, and justice clashed not only with his feelings, but with the very possibility of life. Life without Princess Maria, little as he seemed to value her, was unthinkable to him.
"And why should she marry?" he thought. "To be unhappy for certain. There's Lisa, married to André. A better husband, one would think, could hardly be found nowadays. But is she contented with her lot? And who would marry Maria for love? Plain and awkward. They'll take her for her connections and wealth. Are there no women living unmarried, and even the happier for it?"
So thought Prince Bolkonski.